Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation.
This is Valley Edition, FM 89's weekly look at the issues that matter to the residents of the San Joaquin Valley.
Hello, I'm Juanita Stevenson, and welcome to Valley Edition. On our program today, Fresno Mayor Ashley Sparingen says the city is in deep financial stress. But when the city manager uttered the B word, as in bankruptcy, as an option, it was suggested the administration not toss the word around so lightly. Also, the solar industry is booming in California and the Central Valley. Now there is an effort to tax those who use solar. Plus, using bikes to get kids to do well in school and in life. But first, the city of Stockton is in financial crisis and in pre-bankruptcy talks with its creditors. If it does declare bankruptcy, it would be the largest U.S. city to do so. City leaders are now in mediation with creditors. The city faces a $38 million deficit on a general fund budget of just $165 million. Earlier this month, Fresno Mayor Ashley Sparingen suggested that Fresno's financial situation was just as bad as Stockton's. The city is facing a $2 million deficit by the end of June. The mayor says if action isn't taken, Fresno's budget deficit will be $15 million in 2013 and rise to $65 million by 2017. This after the city, over the last several years, has addressed nearly $100 million in budget shortfalls by cutting workers and services. Earlier this month, she released a 10-year plan to fix the problem. She says the city must choose between laying off more employees and cutting services or adopting a fiscal sustainability policy.
So we're really confronted with two options, and I've heard some of you say, well, why are we talking about this now? We haven't even taken up the budget yet. Well, here's the budget. It's at least a $15 million hole next year and likely an $18 million hole. There's the budget. So what do? Do we cut more services? Do we cut more employees? Which fire station do you want to close? Which park do you want to close? Those are the choices we now face. And in my opinion, those kinds of further reductions in services are absolutely unacceptable. Unacceptable in this city. We cannot do that to the public we represent. Our only option is to work within the number of employees that we have and reduce the cost of our workforce.
Now, when City Manager Mark Scott said if steps aren't taken to solve the city's financial crisis, bankruptcy could be an option, he was criticized. Some people felt it would portray Fresno in a negative light, and the employee unions accused the mayor of using the word in a way to scare unions into making concessions to help balance the budget. Here to discuss this issue with us is Fresno City Councilman Lee Brand and Dan Oney, Editor-in-Chief of Public CEO. Thank you both for joining us today.
Good morning, Juanita.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Okay, good morning to the both of you. First, City Councilman Brand, just how bad is Fresno's finances? And is it fair to compare Fresno to Stockton at this point?
Well, I would say Fresno does have a serious financial issue. I don't believe it is of the magnitude of Stockton, primarily because we don't have the underfunded pension that they did. And more specifically, we did not fund employee health care costs after retirement. Those two factors alone are probably worth millions of dollars. Remember, Stockton was the epicenter for the foreclosure crisis.
Exactly.
So they got hit a lot harder than most people in the state, their local economy. And during that, those boom years of 2001 to 2006, I mean, they just really spent like a drunken sailor and spent the city into oblivion. So you can't put the fault on the labor unions or anybody specifically. It was a combination of a lot of people there that contributed. We, to a lesser extent, have had similar problems. We spent a lot of money in that 2000, 2006, 2007 era.
Many cities did when they were booming.
Yeah, like the money's going to come forever. And I know people have criticized the city, and justly so, for some bad decisions like the Met Museum, $15 million, Granite Park, $5 million. But to put a little context, that's $20 million. It's a one-time loss. If your general fund before we took over is $250 million. It's now about $210, $205. Let's say it averaged $200 million over the past 10 years. That's, you know, what, $2 billion. Every year during that period of time, there were MOUs or labor contracts with all the different bargaining units. If they went beyond a 2% or 3% inflation factor, and let's say that they went a couple percent beyond that, or 3 or 4%, that added to say, let's say, to say $10 million a year in terms of additional benefits, additional wages beyond inflation. That $10 million over 10 years is $100 million.
So you're saying those kind of increases are really more than when you look at what the city is having to pay off in debt for some of those projects.
When you take a bird's eye view and look back for 10 years, you say, how did we get to where we're at right now? Again, Met Museum, Granite Park, mistakes, but they're one-time mistakes. And I'm just putting – I don't have the exact figures, but if it was just 3 or 4%, that's $10 million, $12 million, that's $120 million further behind than we would have been.
Right.
So then you add in some debt service, you know, that was done. The stadium at $3.5 million a year, parking garage $3 million a year, no neighbors left behind bonds, park bonds, public safety bonds.
Lots of bonds.
Yeah.
and Mr. Oney, I want to bring you in on this. What is Stockton's financial status so people can really get a look at them? The city hasn't officially declared bankruptcy at this point, has it?
Correct. I think you bring up an important point, and that's that Stockton hasn't declared bankruptcy. They're on a road that could lead to bankruptcy if they can't find a way to settle their debts or restructure their debts with all their creditors, which is a step further than the next step that Fresno would have to take, meaning that Fresno has introduced its financial or fiscal stability plan. After that, if that wouldn't work, they would have to declare fiscal emergency, and then after that decide to go to AB 506, which is the new procedure for declaring municipal bankruptcy, before declaring bankruptcy. So there are still several steps that need to happen between where Fresno is now, where Stockton is now, and where some other municipalities may be going.
Right.
And I think that the council member hits it right on the nail when you talk about the difference in the impacts of one-time expenditures versus ongoing spending programs, where it's easier to point to, say, the museum than an intangible contract between employees and the city, is look at that money that we spent when that cost is done for the most part, but it's the ongoing costs that are going to continue to plague some of these municipalities that are dealing with ongoing budget crises.
Right. Now, and it is the ongoing costs. That's what we're talking about. And I want to backstep a little bit. Now, would these cities have been okay, let's say, if we hadn't had the housing crisis and then on top of that, the recession with unemployment? What I'm trying to say is back when things were okay and they set this whole thing up, they thought, okay, everything's going to be okay. But I'm trying to find out, really, was it the housing crisis and then the recession that really just kind of uncovered everything? We'll start with you, Mr. Brandt.
Well, I think the fundamental problem in our economy, which is this great recession we've had the last 5 years, I think is the foreclosure crisis. They've never resolved that. You went from a policy of anybody could get a loan, there's no verification, to now hardly anybody can get a loan. So, you know, we still have thousands of homes underwater in the state of California. And you look at it, it's California, Nevada, Arizona, Florida, other states like Texas, North Carolina, North Dakota – are with ag-based economies and diversified economies are really coming out of the recession well, yet we continued, you know, double-digit unemployment. And until that underlying problem is solved, I think this recession will continue on, at least locally and in California.
And Stockton's housing crisis was even worse, wasn't it, Mr. Oney?
Yeah, Stockton was one of the worst-hit cities in the country.
And so that definitely has had an impact on that city and its finances and its ability to recover.
Well, you have to remember that a good portion of municipal finance comes from property taxes. However, that's not the only factor. It's also sales tax, it's local use tax, it's car taxes, you know, registration fees. So I think when you ask whether or not this all happened because of the housing crisis and the Great Recession, if things would have continued as they were in the early 2000s, where people were spending like the economy was going to go forever and the housing market was a sure bet, then I think it would have still happened just later down the road. I think that the Great Recession and the collapse of the housing market really expedited an adjustment in how municipalities govern themselves.
And we talked about that governing situation, Mr. Brand, City Councilman Brand, because you've introduced several policy initiatives to kind of help the city from not making those same mistakes. But as you mentioned, okay, that's done, and you can't really keep going back and talking about those failed projects, so you have to kind of move forward from that. So when you look at declining revenue and you have to cut expenses, I mean, where do you go?
Well, here's the starting point on most city budgets. 80% of the budget is personnel related, salaries, benefits, pensions, et cetera. So we've got roughly $200 million. We've got $40 million that's park maintenance, public works, streets, sidewalks, all those, police, fire, et cetera, where those have been cut to the bone over the last 3 years. So, and we've also had employee concessions, too, that have helped out along the way. But at this point in time, to make this huge gap of $15 million, and what we have is a structural balance. In other words, if we sold, for example, we couldn't do it, the Met Museum for $15 million next year, okay, we've solved the problem for 1 year. But the ongoing obligations in terms of rising health care, rising pension cost, even though there has been concessions on employee groups, certain groups have had like a six-step increase. For example, that alone, that six-step increase, cost the city $3.5 million a year. So without – you have these rising costs, and you have these either flat or declining revenues, sales tax, property tax, room tax, motor vehicle tax, et cetera. So if you project out of the future, unless you find a new revenue stream to match that rising cost – or you reduce those costs through negotiations with your labor groups, that's the only way, in my opinion, we can solve the problem on a permanent basis, not put Band-Aids like I think we've been doing the last 3 years.
I think we have a comment from City Manager Mark Scott and then also from one of the union groups that we'd like to play to show the situation that we're in when it comes to the city and some of the public employee unions.
You can't possibly pay people enough to do things like this. And yet I'm standing here and saying we don't have enough money to pay for the level of benefits that we have agreed to do in the past. And why is that? I think the fact is that the city has tried to be generous to the extent it possibly could in the past, and I think the city has made some mistakes, and we have agreed to benefit levels and to contracts that we can't afford to provide.
The Fresno POA has stepped up over the last several years. Since 2008, they've given a total of $20+ million back to the city of Fresno. They've never said they wouldn't speak to the city. They've never said they wouldn't help the city in its time of economic crisis. True, there hasn't been an agreement reached recently, but look to the very recent past and you'll see that they have stepped up. They've done their share. They've helped the city. They've been cooperative to the extent that they can.
Now, that was a Fresno Police Officers Association attorney Rocky Lucia on the concessions already made by the Police Officers Union. And that is one of the public employee unions that they're having a difficult time negotiating with. Now, let's put this out to the public. When it comes to the city here trying to get back on solid financial footing and being proactive and not waiting until it is too late, do you think public employee unions have to make or need to make more concessions with this? You can give us a call at 800-224-8989 or 559-275-8989, or you can email us at talk@kbpr.org. And in the meantime, I would like to read a comment that we've already received on our Facebook page from Terrell from Fresno, who says, we are in this mess for the same reason most of our government can't stay out of the mess, and that's because the city, state, and the nation does not properly manage a surplus. Is that part of the problem?
Well, if you look at our pension system, that they did a pension obligation bond originally in like 1992-93, and for about a 7 or 8 year period of time, it earned about 17% interest on return, paid about a 5% cost, and that gap would be the surplus earnings was over $300 million. And they used that to pay in part all the police officers that were hired during the 1990s. But they should have started putting that money away. So for almost 7 or 8 years, there was a pension holiday. There was no contributions from the city into the pension fund. It turned on, I believe, in 2008, and it went from a zero to like over $22 million in the last 3 years. So that's a good example where they should have put money aside. I did a reserve policy last year that had – it was very comprehensive, emergency reserve, contingency reserve, technology reserve, capital reserve, vehicle reserve, et cetera. Had that policy been in effect in 1999, by 2009, when I took office, the city would have had an additional $62 million just by putting a couple percent aside.
Well, you know, I can recall going through and covering a number of these budget negotiations. Really, that is one of the first things the employee unions will say. Well, you to the city, whether it's the city, the school district, whatever. Well, you've got money in reserves. You've got this surplus. Why don't you use it to pay?
Well, what had actually happened when we took over in 2009? Ostensibly, we had a $17 million reserve. Within 2 years, it was determined, and it was determined by the parking fund, which I kept looking at. Why is this parking fund going negative? How are you addressing it? Well, what they were doing during the 2002 to 2008 era is they were doing what they call deficit financing. They were taking money from the utility fund to pay off the parking fund. The parking garage that generated $500,000 a year in revenues yet had a $3 million debt service, so they're using other funds. And not only do we not have a $17 million reserve, we had $36 million in negative fund balances. So that was paid down to about 26. It's currently at $30 million. So when we start out fiscal year 12-13, we have a $15 million projected shortfall. We have $30 million in negative fund balances that have to be paid back. And so what the city manager presented was a 10-year workout of around, you know, $2.5 million. But we have to do that. That, in fact, was one of the contributing factors to the credit downgrading, which cost the city dearly in terms of short-term financing.
Right. So what the city manager and the mayor are saying, and I understand that you also support this, that don't try to do this all at once. We see what's coming down the road. We have a plan. Let's put a plan in place so we don't end up like a Stockton or one of the other cities. So that's the message coming from that, correct?
Well, there's two things. One is you can't do it overnight. The hole that was dug for us before we took over is too deep. So it'll probably take 5 or 10 years to effectively balance the budget from a financial point of view. And then the other lesson is that we have policies in place that prevent history from repeating itself. And I did several in the last 3 years, but those are all four votes away from being overturned by some future council. And I've learned in my 3.5 years is that the institutional memory is very short and history repeats itself over and over again. So some of those items will come for a vote as a charter to be maybe on a ballot in November, that if they rise to that level and are approved by the voters, like a Reserve Act or a Better Business Act, Labor Management Act, then they're institutionalized. It'll take a vote of the people to overturn these policies.
Now, Mr. Oney, in a way, correct me if I'm wrong, Stockton, because it hasn't filed bankruptcy, but it's in mediation, so it's trying to work out its debt problems. But in saying that, if they can't put the pension plan on the table, then what does that do to what it is they're trying to do?
Well, it's an interesting process. So last year, the Assembly changed how cities can go about declaring bankruptcy, and they created an impartial mediation system that has to be gone through before you can declare bankruptcy. And every creditor with more than $5 million or a certain percentage of the city's total funds held in debt is considered a creditor to the city. And that includes things like pensions and contracts. Everything is on the table. Now, that process, if they can find a solution during it, is a way to avert a Chapter 9 bankruptcy. But if the city, during the 60 or 90-day negotiation, does become insolvent, they can still go into bankruptcy. Now, once they declare bankruptcy, there is the potential to address pension funds and pension promises that have been made to retirees. It's just a very expensive process, and it brings in very powerful interests. That's why in Vallejo you really didn't see any substantial changes to the pension program, because it was made clear that if they went after the pensions that they'd already promised, that more people would become involved, and Vallejo could be stuck with the legal costs, not only for their own actions, but for the people that they were fighting against. So they were kind of intimidated away from that. The question that's kind of being discussed around municipal finance and throughout the state is, when is that question going to be directly addressed? Is it going to be with Stockton? Is it going to be with San Jose? Is it going to be with any of the other municipalities that are out there? Because pensions are going to be, like the councilman said, pensions and labor costs are such a huge proportion of all cities' budgets that they are going to have to be part of the solution.
Could you see, or is there the possibility then, if a city is really in deep financial stress and they have nowhere to go, that you could see a place like a Stockton or some of the other cities going ahead with bankruptcy as a way to finally address that issue?
I would say, and this is my opinion on this, is that there are quite a number of places across the state that are watching very closely what's happening in Stockton, and also Mammoth Lakes in Southern California. The little ski resort town is also going through AB 506, so they're the first two to ever do it. They're watching very closely to see whether or not the process works, because if they can enter into an AB 506 negotiation, or mediation rather, and resolve some of the ongoing costs that are troubling their budgets, there's going to be a rush towards 506. Just because it enables cities to tackle problems that have been too big in the past to go after. The cost of doing AB 506 in terms of not just the actual cost for lawyers, but towards a city, towards a city's credit rating, are substantially lower than bankruptcy itself.
So what you're saying is once they go through this, and this is a bill that was passed not too long ago, I think, as far as having cities having to go through this mediation process before declaring bankruptcy. Now, what you're saying is that could become an option for cities is to enter into that kind of situation and hopefully try to come to grips or to terms and work out a solution to their financial situation.
Yeah, I would say that. There are thresholds that really need to be met in AB 506. You can't just willy-nilly declare you're going to enter into this. You need to be in a tough financial situation. You need to be trying to avert insolvency. Those sorts of thresholds need to be met before you can do it. But you were correct when you said it was recently passed. It was just last year. This bill that was originally put forward was viewed by many in local government as a dangerous bill because it would have all but prevented municipal bankruptcies. And groups like the League of Cities and other local government advocacy groups worked pretty closely with the legislature to change it, and what ended up coming out was what could be a very helpful process to a bunch of cities out there who are trying to figure out how to come into a new normal in a post-Great Recession economy.
And that's the whole situation, is that we already had an inkling that, you know, you just couldn't continue to do things the way they were. But then the housing crisis and then with the recession, you really do have to kind of look at what you're doing, City Councilman Brandon. Do you think the city will be able, because we hear this every time there's a negotiation, you have the employee union saying no in the city, that with this long-term 10-year plan, that they can take a look at that and say, okay, here's something on the table that we're looking down the line, and we know that every year we won't have to be, you know, 2 or 3 years coming back to the table with that. Is an incentive maybe for them to kind of sit down and really once and for all solve the situation instead of, you know, doing a little bit every year, just kind of pushing it, you know, down the road and not ever dealing with the big picture?
Let me first say that when you do a 5 or 10 year projection, I do this in my business. I used to have clients say, I bought this property. What is it going to look like 10 years from now? Well, beyond 1 year, it's hard to predict. So a 10-year projection is just somebody's guess where things are going to go. But the reality of what we're dealing with is going to be a year-to-year deal because we have to balance the budget each year. This fiscal sustainability policy is more of a philosophical statement. It's just saying this is where we need to go. We need to make certain corrections and certain things like if we can change the health and welfare system the way it's managed, if we can make some changes, for example, that we don't value our funding at 100% on the pension. We can maybe go to 90%, could potentially free up some money on an ongoing basis. Those things can make a difference, but it's probably going to go year to year because, in fact, next year there'll be at least 2 new council members, okay? And then 2 years later, there's 2 new council members. 4 years later, there's a new mayor. So the best laid plans of mice and men, you lay it out there, you try to do your best, but every 2 years, there's going to be a switch on the council, or every 4 years on a mayor. And the labor unions and the bureaucrats are there forever. So we'll see who wins this over time. But my feeling is that we'll continue this. Everybody will act in the spirit of cooperation. I hope people learn from this great recession. But part of me says 10 years from now or 20 years from now, we make it ourselves in the same mess because once the money comes in, it's just human nature. You know, I remember talking to my former colleague Henry T. Perea about what were your budget discussions like 2 years ago or 3 years ago or 4 years ago. And he said, well, Lee, this debate wasn't how to cut cost or rate. It was how do we spend the money? So that one must have been nice back then.
that's a really interesting point. There are terms that have come up recently that didn't exist a few years ago, consolidating services, partial consolidation, total consolidation, where you're looking at multiple departments or multiple cities sharing a motor pool or sharing maintenance facilities because they're trying to find ways to cut budgets, cut expenses while still maintaining services. And I think that was a really foreign concept just a few years ago.
But in the end, no matter how you look at it or what your position is, the cities are going to have to take action. Now, the mayor has laid out, okay, if we don't do this, this is what we could be facing. And then you have a situation where you have people get upset once it's forced on them. But the option is you have to do something. I think everybody agrees you've got to do something about the budget. You've got to do something about the finances so you don't keep going through this same situation. So you can say, okay, we can sit down and work this out, or we're just going to cut. And there are some cities who've already done that and not try to take anything into consideration.
Well, I think we're at the point in Fresno where we can no longer do the temporary measures. We have to. The only way to resolve this huge $15 million, and again, not counting the deficit financing, not counting maybe another multi-million dollar lawsuit looming in the future for, you know, that's our society, all these potential negatives is that we have to get the employee groups, and they've all contributed over the last 3 years. Everybody's did something, including the police. But the economics of it are that the police are 2/3 of our budget. So we need the police to come forward to participate equally with everybody else. And I'm hoping that we can do that, that everybody works on a voluntary basis. And in the past, they have made concessions, but they were always based on
what else I could get.
It was a deferral or an extension. So there's a trade-off. And I believe we're at a point now, there can't be any future trade-offs. At least for this next year, you've got to give, for example, 5% and you get nothing in return.
And that's been part of the problem, hasn't it? During the negotiations, they'll say, okay, we'll give, but we want this down the road.
The MOU in 2010, the city has a leave policy that they pay every officer 96 hours. Well, that's roughly $2.9 million a year. Well, they didn't budget for that. They kept accruing that, so it accrued up to about $10 million. So part of the negotiation in 2010 was they essentially agreed they would finance the $10 million leave policy, so we wouldn't have to pay it out in, theoretically in 1 year. And they did some deferrals on wages that had already been approved by a prior MOU. So we just pushed all these things back. So we got by for that 1 year, but once we come to the following year, we're right back where we started. So that kind of negotiating won't work anymore. We have to get a one-time, I'm going to give up X amount of dollars, and I get nothing in return. And that has never been done. So that's the challenge.
Okay. Thank you. Then we'll leave it right there. Thank you so much, Fresno City Council Member Lee Brand and Mr. Dan Oney, Editor-in-Chief of Public CEO. Thank you both for this great discussion today. And I'm Juanita Stevenson, and you're listening to Valley Edition.
Support for Valley Edition comes from Cahuilla Delta Medical Center and Kaiser Permanente.
You're listening to a rebroadcast of Valley Edition. Welcome back. I'm Juanita Stevenson, and you are listening to Valley Edition. Incentives to get Central Valley residents and businesses to use more solar power appear to be working. Fresno now ranks fifth in the state in terms of the number of solar installations on homes and businesses with over 2,100 projects. The growth of solar in the state has created thousands of jobs and billions of dollars in investment. But some say solar success could be putting its growth in jeopardy. Net metering is a program that they're talking about, and here to discuss this with us is Mr. Tom Cotter with Real Good Solar, a large solar company that's throughout the Central Valley, and Adam Browning with Vote Solar. Thank you both for joining us this morning.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
Okay.
Likewise.
And first of all, I think what it is, a lot of people when we talk about the word term net metering, unless you're in solar, you don't know what it means. But basically what we're looking at, how, first of all, let's talk about somebody who has a solar installation and how does that work? Because they from what I'm understanding, there's a certain time of the year where they don't use all their solar and it goes back to the grid. So let's talk a little bit first about what is that and how does that work if you're an average solar customer?
Right. Well, net metering enables small businesses, schools, farms, retailers, public agencies, and low and middle class homeowners to install solar power systems. The way it works is any time of the day, a solar system may produce more or less electricity than is needed at that moment. If you think back old school, that would have gone to charge a bank of batteries. Now, what's in place is that when the solar production exceeds the building demand, that excess energy generation automatically goes through the electric meter into the utility grid, spinning that meter backwards, and the customer gets a credit on their account.
Okay. So the excess electricity goes into the grid. So other people use it, correct?
Absolutely. The utility then sells that power to that customer's neighbors at the regular retail rate. Now, at other times of the day, the customer's electrical demand may be higher than what the solar is producing. And at that point, you know, the customer relies on additional power from the utility. And so the switching back and forth between the solar and the utility grid power is instantaneous, and customers never notice any interruption in their flow of power.
So basically what you're saying is when you have excess, it goes to the grid. When you're using more, you kind of get a credit because you've already paid in a way.
Exactly. It's like rollover minutes for a cell phone.
Okay. And so this whole, the way this has worked, it's been in place, I'm told, for 15 years. It's in California.
Right. It's been in place for a while. What's interesting is that, Real Goods Solar has been around. We're in our 35th year of business right now. And before net metering laws were in effect, there really wasn't, the prolific solar industry that there is now. It was once net metering laws went into effect that the solar industry really came to be. So now we're at a place where the solar industry is creating jobs seven times faster than any other industry in America right now.
And so because before this, it either way you look at it, solar, it is an expensive investment for those who choose to go solar, to make that initial investment. It's not cheap.
That is the old school way of thinking. Most people, and I speak on solar a lot, and a lot of people when I walk into an audience, they say, oh, solar, you know, I can't afford that. But at Real Goods, most of our customers don't pay anything to get the solar installed.
Okay.
They use a lease or a power purchase agreement, which are two financing vehicles that have really helped the solar industry to become widespread. Most of the people going solar in the Central Valley here are middle class or lower income. You know, if you look at where solar systems are being installed and the zip codes, they've got a median income of around $43,000 a year. So that's not the wealthy. It's not the, you know, environmentally focused people. It's the average, you know, average homeowner.
So between the average homeowner, and you also have a lot of business and schools taking advantage of this as well.
Yeah, there are a number of them. Grundfos Pumps, PR Farms, Mila Vineyards. I mean, I'm just going down some of the people locally who have installed it. Weedman, Snowflake Designs, Valley Document Solutions, Kohl's. We've got a number of churches, including the UU Church of Fresno, Fresno State University, the Fresno Airport, the Fresno Municipal Service Center. We have a lot of solar in the valley. And when you led off this story, you talked about Fresno being the fifth largest area in the state. If you add Clovis to that, you add Clovis and Fresno together, our region is actually the number three solar region in the state.
Mm. So now what some people are saying, all of this success with solar, now that solar is becoming widely used, it's kind of a victim of its own success. Because what I'm reading about or what I've read about is now the utility companies, in a way, want solar customers to pay more or to pay a fee. Explain that to me. Mr. Browning, are you up on that? Can you explain that to us as far as now? What is it they are saying they would like to do?
Sure, I can take that one. Thank you for the for teeing that one up. So what's important to understand is that when someone generates their own solar electricity, what they're producing is really the most highly valued electricity possible. It's produced during peak times of the day when the demand on the whole system is at its highest and electricity is most expensive to produce, and it's being generated really close to load, so you don't have to transmit it from a long way away. So beginning with that premise, there is the charge here that when someone chooses to generate their own electricity, they're not contributing their fair share to the overall grid cost. That is to say that the utility has some fixed charges associated with building the transmission and distribution system. And if someone goes solar and is no longer buying their electricity from the utility, then they're reducing their contribution to the overall pool that goes to those expenses. And, you know, that's definitely true. There is something to that. But what's important to understand is that those costs are more than offset by the extra value that someone generating with solar brings to the system, again, by producing during peak periods when electricity is the most expensive, and doing so in ways that really strengthen the whole distribution grid and can offset necessary investments into building, for example, larger transformers or new transmission lines. So from our perspective, though there are now moves in San Diego Gas and Electric, they introduced a potential additional charge just for solar customers that was found by the regulators as illegal and struck down. From our perspective, the people who choose to go solar, that put a lot of their own money into buying a clean generating system, are really contributing value to everybody, not just their own utility bill.
And so you're saying they are already paying and should not have to pay what some are calling like a solar tax.
That's the premise here. So, you know, what we're asking for here is just fair value, a recognition that solar generation really does bring additional values to the whole grid. This is a policy that is working very well. It's growing jobs and reducing emissions to the environment. And it's really also helping taxpayers as well. If we look at, for example, schools in California that have gone solar, and you look at the ones that have already gone solar as well as the ones who've got solar systems in development that have already applied for their interconnection, and you total all those up and you look at the 30-year projected energy savings from that, it totals $1.5 billion worth of energy savings. Now, that will buy a lot of chalk for a school system that's in financial disarray. So it's important to note here that going solar can be an enormously powerful and beneficial choice, and it impacts everybody, not just the people who choose to invest in a solar system.
Well, there has been an assembly bill introduced, I understand, and is calling for the PUC to complete a study by June of next year to determine the extent to which each class of ratepayer is paying the full cost of services provided to them by utilities under this net metering program. Mr. Carter, what kind of impact do you think it would have on the solar industry if people did have to start paying an extra fee?
That's a good question. First of all, I think it's important to note that in San Diego that this was already struck down as illegal. And so I think that we need to be careful not to make people afraid about something that is pretty far-fetched about happening. You know, solar customers already pay a meter fee. So the utilities are, you know, considering even adding on another fee. I mean, we saw what happened with smart meters. You can imagine what would happen if this became something serious that the utilities were really considering. You know, if you think about it, let's take, you know, a very average, safe situation. Let's say that at my house I pay $150 a month for my PG&E electricity. And I sign up with a power purchase agreement or a lease. And because I have some shade on my roof and it's not exactly optimal, my end electric cost in the first year after I go solar is still $150 a month. So I was paying $150 a month before. Now I'm paying, let's say, $50 to the utility and $100 for my solar payment. So I'm still $150 net. Now, what's going to happen with my power purchase agreement or my lease is, let's say that goes up at 2.9% a year for the next 20 or 25 years. If PG&E is escalating at 6.5% a year on average, then what that means is that over the next 20 or 25 years, maybe I save $20,000 to $40,000 on my cost of electricity. If this net metering fee does eventually come into place, and let's say they start charging me $22 a month, it's maybe going to take another year or two until I'm back to break even again at my cost of electricity. And it may mean over the course of 20 or 25 years that I save, you know, $5,000 or $6,000 less on my electricity. I don't think that when you look at it that way, and when you look at the people who are installing solar, that it's not the rich. It is the average homeowner who are really struggling at times to make ends meet. It really doesn't make sense for a homeowner, a church, a business, or a school in any way.
Okay. Well, this isn't going to go away. It's just beginning to what this new piece of legislation is going to be talked about. We'd like to discuss it again. But I'd like at this point to thank both of you for taking the time to come in and talk with us. Tom Cotter with Real Good Solar and Adam Browning, who is with Vote Solar. Thank you both. I'm Juanita Stevenson, and you are listening to Valley Edition.
The young British band Dry the River is about to release their debut album. They're in the midst of a big U.S. tour, and they still marvel at it all.
One minute we were just rehearsing in our dingy cellar in East London, and the next thing I know we're playing in America, and people are coming to our shows and singing the words to the songs. A strange kind of feeling.
A visit with Dry the River later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
All Things Considered starts each afternoon at 4 on Valley Public Radio.
Hi, this is Juanita Stevenson. You're listening to Valley Edition. In a new addition to our program, several times a month we'll be featuring guest commentaries from Valley Public Radio's long-running series, The Moral Is. We hope these commentaries will make you think about issues ranging from education and ethics to politics and the future of the Valley. In today's commentary, recent allegations of sexual abuse in California schools have parents and educators on edge. Fresno State Professor Jack Benica says that the key to preventing these crimes in the future lies with parents talking to their kids, even when the subject is something unpleasant.
It's springtime, and our valley is alive with orchards of blossoming trees and longer and warmer days. With the impending spring, we tend to forget the dreariness of the past. And indeed, we've left some dark winter days behind. In some ways, it seems like the winter of 2012 was a winter of child abuse scandals. The first occurred across the country, where former Penn State assistant coach Jerry Sandusky was charged with abusing at least 10 boys under the cover of a children's charity he founded. Then, in February, came two cases of bizarre teacher sexual abuse in the same Los Angeles school. In the most egregious, the teacher was charged with binding and blindfolding his elementary school students and conducting bizarre and lewd acts against them. And then there was the case in our own neighborhood, in Clovis, where another elementary school teacher was charged the same week with 45 counts of child molestation against a 7-year-old pupil in his own darkened and locked classroom. These cases beg a series of questions. How safe, really, are kids in schools? What can parents do to be more vigilant? What should they say to their children? Data on school sexual abuse are difficult to collect. Such studies require self-reports about unwanted contact by teachers and other school personnel, and subjects resist those types of inquiries. But a few studies have been conducted, the most notable of which was done by Professor Carol Shakeshaft, then of Hofstra University. In 2004, she published an extensive report indicating that perhaps as many as 10% of U.S. public school students are subjected to sexual misconduct by an employee of the school, sometime between kindergarten and 12th grade. According to a recent story in Time magazine, 2,570 educators were found to have engaged in sexual misconduct over the 4-year period between 2001 and 2005, and more than 80% of those cases involved children. It sounds like a lot of cases, and it is. But by comparison, there are more than 6 million teachers in our land. The problem of teacher sexual abuse, though not rare, is very uncommon. That's why, when it does occur, we are shocked. Yet, we should remain vigilant, and the best way to do that is through clear communication with our kids. Catherine McCall, a marriage and family therapist, wrote in Psychology Today that talking with your children about sex, and particularly about sexual abuse, is one of the most unpleasant aspects of parenting. Yet, a website called rainn.org gives some very practical advice to parents. If there was something your child said or did that made you concerned, ask about that, and ask in a non-judgmental way. Talk to your children about when it's okay not to keep a secret, even if they made a promise. Tell your children that it's okay to say no to touches that make them feel uncomfortable, and tell them that some parts of their body are private. As hard as it is to broach such matters, doing so will open channels of communication. Spring is again coming to the Central Valley. It's a time of new beginnings. The fruits and vegetables that will emerge unspoiled later in the year will be those for which much care was taken during production. Just so with our children. For The Moral Is, this is Jacques Benninga.
The commentary series The Moral Is was produced by Valley Public Radio in association with the Bonner Center for Character Education at California State University, Fresno. The opinions expressed are those of the writer and not necessarily Valley Public Radio. Send us your comments with an email. The address is talk@kvpr.org.
You're listening to a rebroadcast of Valley Edition. Welcome back. I'm Juanita Stevenson, and you are listening to Valley Edition. Joining me now is Mike Sladen. He is with a very interesting group, and happy to have him in to talk about this. The name of your organization is Off the Front. First of all, tell us what Off the Front is.
Off the Front is a cycling term for a rider in a race who's gotten off the front of the pack. So the imagery of that is that they're winning or they're succeeding, hence the kind of the mission statement of Off the Front is to help kids succeed in the race of life. So that's kind of where our name came from.
And how did you come up with this idea? And when you say off the front, because bikes play a big part in this.
Absolutely. I think for me it was just kind of one of those wild hair ideas of a personal area of passion of mine as a cyclist and seeing the needs in the Valley, specifically in Fresno, with poverty and our school system and kind of all those things came together and formed kind of off the front. So the idea was just to be a blessing and a help to the school systems and the kids here in the Valley and maybe give them a nice carrot, if you will, to succeed well and do well in school and to make a difference.
Tell us how it works.
So phase one of Off the Front, we're pretty creative with our titles, but phase one, we call it, is where we work with the fourth graders, as you mentioned. And those kids set customizable goals in academics, character, and service. And if they're able to achieve those goals over 9 months school year, those kids get a brand new bike, lock, and helmet in June. So we've got about almost 400 kids across 5 schools in Fresno and Clovis that are currently participating in that program. So we hope
to
give away.
So that means you got to give away 400 bikes.
Yeah.
You've got to come up with 400 bikes.
Yeah, I get to do Christmas in June. So it's one of the highlights of my year. We have volunteers come in and build all those. It's amazing seeing those kids achieve those goals and light up at the end of the year.
And how do you go about, I mean, 400, that's a lot of bikes. Do people donate them? Do you build them? How does that work?
What we've done previously is we had a gentleman down in Southern California that owned a bike shop that heard about what we were doing and said, man, we would love to help you, love to be a blessing to what you're doing. He's provided bikes to us at a great cost these last 2 years. But this year, because of the numbers that we're at, we had to import from overseas. So we've got a whole container of bikes arriving here in the next few weeks from China. 440 bikes in a container, so we've had to kind of expand our operations a bit.
And, you know, tell us a little bit about what you've seen the differences make in a child's life, because so many people think of a bike. Okay, everybody has a bike, but not every kid does. And not only that, some of the neighborhoods in which these young people live, it's some would say it's not conducive to bike riding. So I think it's not only to try to help them get out and develop a love for bikes, but the exercise and to kind of introduce them to biking.
Absolutely. Well, I think as we think about as we were kids and the first time you threw your leg over the top tube of a bike and rode for the first time and the freedom and the energy and the rite of passage that was for you and I, all of our listeners can identify with that, and our kids do as well. And we specifically target kids that a brand new bike may not be an option for them. You know, we work with a lot of kids in the impoverished areas of Fresno, so this is a really big deal. We've obviously seen tremendous results in academic success with our kids and English language arts and math scores going up. So that's been a piece of it that we kind of measure. The intangible pieces, which I think are even almost more fun, are the stories that we hear. I talked to a fifth grade teacher, at Susan B. Anthony earlier this year, and she said, Mike, I had my students put a timeline together of the most significant events that have occurred in their lives. And she said most of those kids who had earned bikes the previous year as fourth graders, one of their major events in their lives was earning a bike through Off the Front. So our hope is these kids, they understand that and they can achieve a customizable goal over a long period of time. And they understand that that can translate to other areas of life, that they if they can be successful in this, then maybe they can maybe break cycles of their life and achieve great things. So we just want to be a help in that process.
But you said a key thing here. You said they earned their bike.
Absolutely.
What is it that you – what goals do you want them to set? What goals do they set?
Well, we get asked frequently by those kids, who pays for these bikes? And I tell them, you do. You pay for these. These are not giveaways. You've got to earn them. And if you can accomplish goals in academics, first of all, your English and language arts scores, we need to see those improve. And you don't have to be an A student. You don't have to be a rocket science. I certainly wasn't. But if you can demonstrate improvement in those areas, you're kind of competing against yourself. So that's the first big area. The second is character. Fresno has the six pillars of character within their school district, and we give them opportunities to demonstrate responsibility or trustworthiness, and they report back to those. Or they can get caught, as we call it, demonstrating positive character. And a teacher or a fellow student can basically tell on a kid and say, I saw this kid doing this action. He picked up trash on the playground and demonstrated positive character. And then the last is service. They need to give back to the community, be it at home, at school, at church, at Boy Scouts, whatever it may be. But we want them to be giving back to Fresno and beyond, and they earn points in all those areas. And that's how they come up with the points to earn on the bike.
And a part of this is to also tackle childhood obesity, because I think in the area that you target of Fresno, they do have an issue with childhood obesity.
Absolutely. One-third of kids in Fresno County, nationwide for that matter, are either overweight or obese. And the bike for us is a means, not an end. The goal is not to give a kid a bike and say, hey, congratulations, good luck, see you later. The goal is for that to be a kind of a mode of transportation for them to use it. So the second year, we launched what's called phase two of Off the Front, where we motivate students to actively commute to school. And we reward them for doing that. We track those kids at how often they commute, and they get wristbands and kind of smaller incentives throughout the year. And then they get bigger prizes at the end of the year based on the number of times that they commute. And our hope is to make that a tool where that becomes a normal part of their lifestyle, where activity and they're exercising in a way that maybe they don't even know they're doing. It's just fun. They ride their bike and they love it, but it's contributing to that.
Now, you said right now you're getting ready to go through this process of building all these bikes for a giveaway. Who do you get to come together to help you with this?
Boy, anybody and everybody.
Are you saying you need volunteers?
Absolutely, I am. It doesn't take a rocket scientist to build a bike. So there's a lot of folks that come, and we get to put these bikes together. So if we have listeners that may be interested in that, you can check out our website or email us at info@offthefront.org, and we can tell you more about it. We're going to do four different builds this year because we have so many bikes. We'll have to do them over a kind of a longer period of time, and we'll put them all together here in the months to come.
And who helps you identify the students? Is that something they do through the school or?
Well, if we enter into a school, we open the possibility up to every fourth grader that's there. So unless they say, hey, no, we don't want to earn a bike, or the parents say we don't want our child to participate in that, they're in. So we begin with principals and teachers.
So then after that, it's up to the student. Then.
Absolutely. So in our job, we have volunteers that go into the classroom on a weekly basis and motivate and encourage those kids, keep tracks with them, develop relationships with those kids, and they're kind of cheerleaders / coaches for the kids. They're the adult that's saying, look, I believe in you and you can do this, and let's work on your math homework and let's see if we can get those grades up or whatever it may be.
So you also have volunteers then to help the kids with their schoolwork and to help them sort of stay on track.
Absolutely. That's the crux of our program. Our volunteers are our heroes, and we have amazing people behind the scenes that give up time off work, whatever it may be, to be in the classroom. They spend an hour or two a week working with those students. And the idea is we want to be able to come in the classroom and not be a burden. We don't want to put one more thing on the teacher's plate and say, hey, you need to be tracking these things or you need to watch these kids and their points. That's our job. So if we can come in and be a blessing to the school system and the teachers and say, we're going to try to get these kids to do well in areas that you already want them to do well in, and if we can come in and offer a carrot that's free of charge, free of labor, and come alongside and partner with them, well, then we feel like all parties win in that.
Wow, that's great. What a great idea. And you guys have been at this. You haven't been at it for that long, have you?
No, we're pretty new. 2.5 years. So this is our third year in the schools currently.
Okay, well, good luck with this next bike giveaway. Over 400, you said.
You got it right around
400. So there's 400 great kids out there who are going to get a bike.
You got it.
Thank you, Seth. Thank you so much, Mike, for coming in and sharing about this wonderful program, Off the Front, and your email address again for people.
Info@offthefront.org.
Okay. Thank you. Well, that is all for today's Valley Edition. You can hear audio archives and subscribe to our podcast online at kbpr.org. We welcome your comments and suggestions. You can email us at talk@kbpr.org. For audio engineer Marv Allen, production and operations manager Don Weaver, and executive producer Joe Moore, I'm Juanita Stevenson, and this is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation.